started?
Why don't you? Why haven't we started?
Can we not start by saying we started this time? Why don't you give us a nice intro, Matthew?
Dan makes a great cup of instant coffee.
Thanks very much.
If ever you want to come to Urchin, Dan does the best instant coffee you've ever had.
Nescafe Azera is the chosen. That's the best. That's the best balance between speed and agility flavor. I think hot beverages in the studio are, you know, I don't know if it's a British thing.
Essential.
But I think it's an essential, you know, not that nobody try and apply for jobs that we don't have. We've had a lot, let's be honest, we've had a lot.
Yeah, let's talk about that. This we've had, since the beginning of the year, more.
A dozen, I would say.
More than we've ever had. Well, I'd say people asking for jobs and also people asking just for internships, people at,
yeah,
couple of kids, 14 year olds, that want work experience.
Yeah, and then a lot of like kind of graduate level people.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me reminds me just how difficult this industry is to get into.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really difficult.
Yeah. Maybe, I mean,
on a downer this week.
Yeah, no, well, it's not that it's difficult. I mean, it is difficult.
Yeah.
Well, it's difficult to get a job in a studio.
Yeah, because there's not many studios.
No, and that's what, you know, when we started back in 2007, which it turns out, I met a potential client yesterday who was 18.
Wow.
And I said we started in 2007, and I thought approximately when that was, how old they were when we started the studio, and then I didn't want to think about it anymore.
They were five.
They were five. Are you sure?
Were they not?
Anyway, they were a toddler, which made me feel really old. But
you are old.
When we started in this industry back in 2007.
I mean, it was hard to get into then.
Yeah. I sent, when I got my internship, I can't remember if we talked about this in the Story of Urchin episodes.
Yes.
But I got my internship in a studio by sending a MySpace message.
Wow.
Which, you know, I don't think that would work anymore. You know, that's not career advice.
It's because MySpace doesn't exist.
MySpace still exists.
Does it?
Didn't Justin Timberlake buy it?
I don't know.
But like, but yeah, so don't, whatever you do, if you're trying to get a job in a studio, don't send a MySpace message. You probably won't get a response. But the reason I sent a MySpace message at that time was because I'd already actually sent quite a lot of CVs out to studios, emails, and got kind of, was lucky to get some responses, because it's, you know, let's be frank here. We're very busy, and If we had a job advertised, obviously it would be fair enough for us to respond. But unfortunately, we can't respond to every application for a job that we don't have.
Yeah, we don't have any jobs currently.
We don't have any jobs. But the reason I sent the most of this message was because I was kind of thinking outside the box a bit. And I was like, how do I cut through the probable barrage of CVs? And I was like, send cash. So that's kind of like, if I was, occasionally people phone up to ask, still don't have a job, guys. There is no job. But if they phone up, I often have a bit of a chat with them. I think the thing that's way different now is that when we started, you couldn't really kind of, have your home set up and just like start working with artists from home.
Is it because the home setups weren't very good? Or,
well, there was, working off a laptop was a very high end thing to do. Interfaces sounded shite.
And
I guess were a bit,
back then,
bit junky and unreliable.
I didn't know anybody back then who was mixing at home and getting songs in any sort of commercial area.
Getting results. Yeah.
Yeah. And now people are doing that.
Yeah. Whereas now, like, half the time, I mean, like, I spoke to someone a couple of months ago who was asking about a job, and I got to chatting about what they were doing. And it turned out they were at uni. They had access to studios at uni. I mean, I think we have talked about why that's not quite the same as doing live fire sessions, but still got access to stuff. And then they had, I think they were living in a student house where they could record drums in the house. And I was like, dude, the last thing you want to do is get in a studio and start kind of sitting, not doing very much. I mean, a lot of studio assisting and running is, you get exposed to the environment, but, and obviously you learn, pick up stuff, but there's a lot of sitting.
There's a lot of very good mixers who started by shadowing other mixers.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of Ben Bapti,
yeah.
Apprenticeship with Tom Elmhurst.
I think with mixers, it's maybe a little bit different.
But if you're doing that, I guess you get to learn process and really, you know, look under the hood of what those great mixers are doing.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, I still think...
And just to say, a lot of great producers ended up started off by shadowing other great producers.
Yeah.
And then learning the process.
Having a mentor of some sort is very, very helpful, you know. But at the same time, it's like, if you've already got the opportunity, if you've got a space of your own to kind of screw around in and explore, I think it's a bit different now that there's so many tips and tricks online. Many of them are bad, many of them are good. But also, but there's a lot of, the one thing that all of those tips and tricks give you is like inspiration.
Yeah.
You know, like I often get, I haven't mentioned TikTok in a few weeks, so, you know, but if I see a production tip on TikTok, I would say most of the time I know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
But sometimes, but I'll watch it anyway, because sometimes there's a little bit of a like, oh, okay. Ah, okay. They do it that way.
Yeah.
And you go like, I'll try next time I'm doing that thing. Let me try doing it that way.
But do you know what I thought as well? Like the difference between picking up a trick online, on Instagram, on TikTok, whatever, and the difference between sitting down and actually watching someone do it.
Yeah.
I think the thing you don't get, or the thing that you get when you're watching someone, is kind of conviction. Conviction.
Yeah.
And this is something I've been thinking about recently. I just think conviction is so important. Like doing, it doesn't matter. I think about the things that I do. It doesn't really matter whether I'm playing the drums or producing or mixing. It's just like, I'm going to go for this.
Right.
I'm not going to fuck around.
Okay.
And I'm going to go for the jugular of this thing. And I think,
is that conviction or confidence or
both? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, confidence, but the ability to kind of go for it and like not
see an idea through.
And you know, I just remember when we first started, well, when I first started particularly, I was sort of scared of like effects and what happens if I go too far? And you know, compressing things too hard and looking at, you know, and now it's just like, I don't give a shit. I just like,
yeah. Do you know, I was actually
quite aggressive with those things if needed.
I was thinking about this yesterday, actually, and there's a word to add to that, which is kind of, self-belief isn't the right word, but I'm going to go with it anyway. There's a sort of confidence in your own ideas, perhaps.
Yeah.
I remember when we started the studio, you and I worked together on every session for probably like the best part of 2 years.
Maybe more.
Before we started kind of working independently.
Before we started fighting.
Yeah. But
Dan threw the first punch.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, Matt's a lot taller than me, but you know, my arms are longer than they look. Yeah. Nah, I got him while he was down. What I was going to say is nowadays we jump, we fulfill all sorts of roles, you know, sometimes, you know, both of us, sometimes we're mixer, sometimes we're producer, sometimes we're engineer, fulfill all the roles. Often we're backing singer.
Sometimes.
I actually did quite a good little bit of backing vocals with the band the other day, but that's an aside.
Moving on.
Yeah, exactly. I was not horrified with the results of my own backing singing, which is a testament to how long we've been doing this.
Yeah.
If you practice something enough.
Come on, but go on.
Yeah. The point was, you used to fulfill the role of producer,
yes,
and I was engineer.
Yes.
And we didn't switch roles very much. And when we started, I didn't have probably any confidence in my production ideas.
Yeah.
I kind of always deferred to you.
And I would say the same for me. I didn't have any confidence in what I was hearing.
Right.
Like
from an engineering point of view.
Yeah, I would just say, I just totally left it to you.
But do you remember you kind of used to approve all my mixes up to a point?
I don't, what do you mean approve?
There was a point in terms of our like Urchin Mark One system, we would do a session together. I would then mix it sort of on my own or for a bit.
Yeah.
And then you would then give some feedback on that.
I'd say it still works like that for... No.
Matt still approves all my mixes.
Not really. No, but if I've worked as a producer and as a mixer.
Mm.
If I'm mixing something, the producer kind of needs to give it a tick as well as the artist.
Yeah.
You know.
But I didn't have like nowadays, I mean, both of us, if we don't get feedback, if we don't get very much feedback from an artist on the mix, we just carry it through to our own vision
exactly
of the results, you know.
Yeah, which hopefully is also the artist's.
Yeah. But sometimes the you know, the artist doesn't, it's not that the artist doesn't know what they want, but sometimes they don't have a vision of the production and you have to visualize that kind of that goal for them.
Yes.
And go like, okay, you're not quite sure. Don't worry. We're going to try some stuff out. How about we add a beat that goes something like this? Or why don't we try some bass? And you help them explore what they might want, you know? But in order to do that, you've got to have a kind of a confidence and a vision on their behalf as a producer. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. And I'd also say that certain artists are, I was going to say, what's another word for pernickety that's a bit nicer? Artists are...
Specific?
Specific, thanks.
Mm-hmm.
I think artists should be pernickety about certain things, but artists can be specific about any part of the process. I've worked with artists who are, it's just really all about the song.
Yeah.
And they're really specific and they'll agonize over a fucking lyric for a week.
Yeah.
And then once the song's written, they're less, they're less specific about things. And then I've known artists, you know, artists that are super specific about the mix.
Yeah.
You know, the specificness can fall in it at any point in the process.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know,
which is a good thing. Sometimes it can be frustrating on our side sometimes with these things, because sometimes there's a communication issue because we don't speak we don't speak the same language, which is totally fine. But it also creates the rich tapestry of what like makes different artists who they are. If everyone cared about the snare sound, you didn't set the timer, did you?
I didn't set the timer. I'm just going to set it for...
Right.
For
it's a short 20, episode.
20 minutes.
I'm out of here.
No, but I was going to say something there. I'm going to be very honest here, actually.
Mm.
I used to be, I'm going to say this. I used to be quite sort of threatened by artists being specific or pernickety.
Mm-hmm.
Because when I was maybe less confident, I would take that as a sign of almost criticism of my work.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It would just push all my insecure buttons.
Mm.
And if an artist said, this isn't really done, I would just instantly get defensive, which really doesn't help.
It's a natural human reaction. And I think, you know, that's still part of it sometimes.
Yeah. And sometimes, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, that they might be right or I might, but what I'm saying is that if an artist now says to me, I don't really like this or this isn't done, I'm way more okay, cool.
Yeah.
Let's go and let's see what we can do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because actually, I find as well, it's like, yeah, if the artist wants to push it a bit further, they're usually right more often than not, you know?
Or I see it as...
Sometimes they're not, and that's also fine.
Sometimes that's also fine. I mean, my kind of method, if you like, of doing things is that, oh, you almost have to drive past the destination.
Yeah.
To know that
you
you've got it. Because I always think, well, is this getting any better?
Mm.
And if it is, and it's obvious if it is, oh, this is really just becoming more itself somehow.
I like that concept of driving past the destination and coming back, because that can apply to like to something on the quite macro level, like is the middle eight good enough? You know, something like that's just fairly fundamental. Or it can be in chorus two, can I just hear a bit more backing vocals? You know, like, or if someone says, this is the worst industry secrets reveal ever, but if somebody says, can I hear the backing vocals a tiny bit louder? I tend to just put it quite a bit louder.
Look, what are you talking, like 3 dB?
Well, the dBs don't sort of matter, because I think it's a perception thing. But like generally, yeah, if someone says a little bit, I'll try 1 dB. That usually constitutes a little bit. But the problem sometimes is, particularly if you're doing like mixed feedback over email, that can go around the houses a few times.
Yes, it can.
And it can be like, oh, can I just have a little bit more backing vocals? Yeah, okay. And then you do it and you send it again. It's like, I see a little bit more, just a little bit, but it can go three or four times. Whereas if you just put the backing vocals up like five, then
are they loud enough now? Can you hear them?
But then you have a measure of the extremes, is you already know what too quiet is. And rather than like nudging up two or three times from too quiet to the right point, sometimes it's just good to go like, we know what too quiet is, let's hear what too loud is.
Yeah.
And then we, on the third attempt, we get a sense of what's in between. And what's cool as well is sometimes if you make it too loud, what you think is too loud,
yeah,
it's actually more exciting.
Yes.
Sometimes, because sometimes, you know, things need to be loud sometimes. Things
and
need
also,
to be quiet sometimes.
Sometimes you hear, I was thinking about this the other day, you hear a song that you know really well that you haven't heard for 5 years.
Mm.
And you go, fuck, that snare drum's loud. But like really loud, or that or tambourine, or that
the
BB
tambourine.
Or, excuse me, the tambourine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, God, that, wow, that's loud. I've never noticed it before.
Yeah, because the song's cool and the track's cool. On the subject of the tambourine, though, there was someone made a very good TikTok point the other day, which is that in the old days, not the old days like 2007, but when records were on vinyl and tape and whatnot, the tambourine probably wasn't as loud. It's just that the playback system didn't have the tops. Didn't have the top end.
Yeah.
So the it's tambourine is now louder than it was.
10K attack.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Right. I wanted to talk about my jumping off point.
Your plugin of the week?
No, my plugin of the week.
Okay.
I want to talk to you about something, because I've been thinking about this a lot. I want to talk about compression.
Okay.
I
don't use it.
Yeah. No, it's because I've been mixing a lot recently.
Yeah.
But the thing that I've really been noticing is when compression is too much compression is added on a mix.
Okay.
Specifically on drums.
Yeah.
And on lead vocals.
Okay. For the listeners at home that don't know what compression is, can you summarize compression in less than a 36-episode podcast?
Can you?
It's very difficult to explain.
It's hard, isn't
it? But we all know the sound of compression. For the lay person, it's the sound of things being squeezed. And that's all you can really do. We have to do like a compression special.
Am I getting too geeky here?
No.
But specific.
Because I think you're going to talk about taste anyway.
Well, yes, I am. Yes, I am. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's specific. What I hear specifically now, I like compression as much as the next band.
We all love a bit of compression.
But it's when the attack and release aren't right.
Okay.
because I realized that when I'm mixing, I spend quite a long time getting the attack and the release of the compression right.
Mm-hmm.
And I find particularly on the, like snare, like some anything transient-y.
Yeah.
So it can be a picky guitar or it can be, if that's being pushed back too much, if I can just, you know what I mean? It, you can hear the transient just coming up to the compressor and the compressor being, thou shalt not pass, you know, getting all Gandalf on the transients, right? It, and also on vocals.
Sometimes you want that though. As long as that thing's supposed to be in the background.
Well, this is what I mean about, well, exactly. But I guess I'm talking about the sort of kick, snare, and the vocal.
Mm.
Just being pushed too far back, it really bothers me.
Yeah.
And like I was listening to it talk about, you know, your sort of memory of things. I was listening to a record, I'm not going to say what it is, that I used to love.
Mm.
And then I heard it recently over the weekend, and I just thought, oh, fuck, the release and the attack on the snare is all wrong.
Oh,
and it's sort of like,
how do you unhear that?
That's the only thing I could hear. And it just dulled it.
Are you going to tell us what the record was?
No, I'm not.
Okay. Oh, no, not, it's actually too sensitive. It hurts.
No, well, I think maybe it's just because I'm in mix mode at the moment.
I'm
really in those details. Of things. Mm-hmm. But what I was going to say about compression, because I really like the sound of compression.
Mm-hmm.
And I like that sort of saturation and that closeness it can bring.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm I'm really sensitive to particularly the attack time.
Mm.
Do you have a similar ick when it comes to?
I do the attack. I'm not so like, I'm not on an attack time kind of tip at the moment.
Okay.
But I do think, I've never been a fan of really heavily compressed mixes. Because I just think it kind of ruins the music. And the example I'm going to give is, do you know when you just like something just pops into your head? And I was like, I think I had a 20 minute cycle. I think it was yesterday. And I was like, for some reason, I was just like, I just really want to hear the Doctor Who theme, you know? Because
the Ridge?
Well, yeah, kind of. But so I just tapped in Doctor Who theme into Spotify and it came up with the playlist, a couple of playlists down was the like Doctor Who themes from the start to now.
Yeah.
It's really interesting to listen to.
Is it the same
one? So musically it's the same thing. Yeah. So what's interesting is like the very first one, it is a little bit like, whoa, this is kind of, whoa, you know. Obviously, at the time, whenever it, I can't remember when Doctor Who first came out, but.
Is it like 60s?
Yeah. But it would have been mind blowing because you wouldn't have heard the, whatever they were
doing in the 60s to do that.
Whoever's a synth nerd out there can, you know, email in, tell us what synths they were using. But, you know, it's like, yeah, but it all sounds a little bit flat. Like the first kind of, I don't even know how many versions there are. I think I listened to like 15 versions or something.
Wow.
Because it's only you know, 90-second piece of music at its longest. So the first one is a bit flat, and like the timing of everything's a little bit
fruity
because it's all analog gear.
Yeah, yeah.
And then it's like version 2, 3, 4, 5 or something. Yeah, like, this is the one that I wanted to hear.
Slick. It's like Skrillex.
Yeah.
Version 5.
No, because it gets a bit Skrillex later on. And then there's this point, and again, I wasn't, you know, I was on my bike, so I wasn't like looking at the dates of everything, but I think it's where you hit the kind of 90s Doctor Who movie.
Yeah.
And they added drums.
Oh, really? Did they?
Yeah. There's so, I'll send it to you.
It's like a backbeat.
That kind of thing. Or at least I think it gets there. But
the Muse beat.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem. Like, as soon as the drums and stuff come in and everyone, whoever the composer is, and, you know, I can't get around criticizing the people who arranged this, so sorry in advance to those people. That point where it hits in the kind of late 90s, they start, the arrangement gets crowded And also the sound of the mix just becomes a blob, like a distorted, mushy blob. And it's just like, this is not, there's this kind of the curve of like, of how much, how enjoyable these versions of the theme are. It's like, it starts off high, it gets very high, then it dips way down. And just when you get to this splodgy 90s, 2000 sort of CD kind of era, like loudness wars stuff. And then as you kind of come back to where we are now, like the dynamics come back into it a little bit. And it's in the arrangement as much as it's in But like, but when an arrangement's really crowded, it's very easy to turn it to just a splodgy mess.
So was that an example of we were talking about compression earlier an overcompressed mix ruining your listening enjoyment?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of expected, because I was thinking about, it's like, well, we're listening to the same. It's a very unusual thing actually to listen to, because it's the same piece of music,
right?
But rearranged 15 or 16 different times at probably 5-year intervals. So it's a really good, like,
I'm totally going to listen to that.
Yeah, because now I think about it, I'm just sort of like, what other example is there of that? Like a composition which has been remade every five years. Well, there's a gap in Doctor Who. But anyway, everyone go and listen. I'll put it in the show notes. Do you want to talk about plugin of the week?
Oh, yeah.
Because we're probably running out of time, aren't we?
My plugin of the week, yes. My plugin of the week is the UAD, the Galien Krüger.
Bass amp. Yeah.
Fuck, it's good.
Isn't it good? It's good to say. We've not talked about this because you wouldn't let me talk about it.
No, Matt came in and he wanted to talk to me about it.
What was good for me, right? I've been struggling with on bass. I like bass lines and bass parts that can be quite present.
Yeah.
So they have low end, but they also have that sort of like 1-2K attack happening as well.
Which in most cases is very useful. Stuff.
Yeah. So you can hear it on the iPhone. You know what I mean? And I just thought that Galien Krüger has that kind of, you know, upper mid range boost.
Yeah.
That's just like giving you all the presence.
Yeah.
Without any of that, it didn't sound harsh.
Nah.
And I'm using it on a mix I'm doing currently, and it's just delivering, man.
Yeah. For some reason,
was that what you were enjoying about it?
Yeah. I used it. On, I think it was Susie Stapleton's album, which I mixed about 5 or 6 years ago.
Why didn't you tell me about it then?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just kind of fallen by the wayside somehow.
I should say what it is. It's the Galien Krüger by Brainworks 800 RB.
There you go. Yeah. And because it's Brainworks, it's probably available not as a UAD plugin as well. I will check.
I'll put that
in the show notes whenever the hell I'm going to edit this. But
it's good aside.
Susie came in and said, like, oh, what about the bass sound on, you know, like the Galien Krüger amp is what Radiohead use. And I think we listened to. National Anthem. Yeah.
Tom York plays bass on that.
Does he now?
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought that was a bit harsh.
Poor Colin.
Well, that's what I thought. I thought, I was thinking, it's just like, it's probably the only Radiohead song that's a bass feature, and Tom York goes, give me the bass, I'm going to do this.
Did you think it was one of those, like, the Beatles White Album things where, like, maybe Colin quit the band?
And maybe.
He comes in the next day, it's like, oh, fuck, Tom's playing all my parts. Very small aside, back in the USSR and Dear Prudence, on the Beatles White Album.
Paul on drums.
Paul on drums, because Ringo had quit, and he was like, good luck, guys, making an album without your drummer. And they just carried on making the record.
Don't let me go down a Beatles hole.
No,
carry on.
We haven't got time. But yeah, the GK, I think we touched a little bit on like soft synths and soft amps a couple of episodes ago. I am very much in the camp of, like, when it comes to electric guitar sounds, I still really like to use a real amp. When it comes to bass, I just like The key difference is DI'd electric guitar sounds pants.
DI'd electric bass sounds fine.
Yeah.
Maybe even good.
And it's, yeah, when it comes to like that GK amp, it's because you're kind of EQing it right at the source.
Yes.
And that can have a huge impact on the way that the bass sits in the mix. Do you know what I mean?
Totally.
So it's like, what, because there's a lot of kind of power in the EQ on that plugin as well.
So much. I was thinking, God, what else can I send through this?
Right.
Like shakers or I don't know.
Yeah, interesting.
Just like,
yeah.
Or a snare, like just that, I don't know how they do it, but yeah, just that presence it gives.
Yeah. And
it's so nice.
And it's very useful to be able to run that within the mix itself. Like I've often found when we record bass amps, I'm just kind of like, I sometimes just like, I don't know if we're recording what we need here. You know what I mean? And I've always had that sense of like, because with bass, you always take the DI.
Yes.
You don't, it's only the fool doesn't take a DI of the bass.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, it's like whenever we've had a bass amp at various times, we don't own a bass amp. And I'm realizing why. Is like you record the amp, and then often I find I go back to the DI anyway, and then work with that. Once I'm in the mix, I'm like, the amp's not doing.
Though I feel
I what
just,
I want.
I've just thought about this. I feel that if a bass player came in with like a really specific sound,
yeah.
I'm not saying bass players don't have a specific sound.
Sometimes they do. Yeah. Definitely.
Sometimes they do, but I guess they don't have a sound as much as guitar players have. Am I talking shit?
No, you're right. Well, you don't put bass, most of the time you don't put effects on bass.
Yeah.
You EQ and compress, but you don't really put reverb on bass.
No, and you don't
hardly
put
ever.
Like...
Maybe a touch of delay as something that's very idiosyncratic.
Yeah.
Maybe a teeny bit of chorus sometimes. Yeah.
I guess that like...
But you don't get bass players with like a two-level pedal board of like...
Yeah. And that's an envelope generator, isn't it?
Yeah.
But that was very 90s, wasn't it? Flea.
What's that song?
Chameleon by Herbie Hancock.
There you go, yeah. That's a bass part, right?
Boom, 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 boom. Could that have been like a synth bass though?
Could have been.
Was it? Can a bass geek let us know about that?
Well, it sort of doesn't matter because whether they're actually playing a bass guitar or not, it's still the bass part. I get, and that's the point, isn't it?
Yeah,
Most of the time, the bass instrument doesn't have effects on it, and often it can't because what you really need is bass from
the low end
from the bass.
And exactly.
The more you distort or effects, you know, you sort of erode that low end with effects.
Yeah, that's it. Dad, what are you doing this week?
What I'm doing this week is what I'm going to be doing for the next 4 weeks, which is...
Dad's got a big gig.
We've got a chonky album. I'm going to call it an album project. I'm engineering.
It's a four-weeker.
Yeah, it's a four-weeker. So I think we're aiming to come out the other side with an album. The brief is a pinch open-ended. What's going to be fun though is that the reference for the sounds is Bone Machine by Tom Waits.
Oh, yes,
we
love that record.
Which, on the whole, sounds like it's been recorded from the other side of the room.
Yeah,
at all
didn't
times.
Chad Blake do that?
I don't know.
I know Chad Blake did.
I didn't dig
a number
into
of
it.
Tom Waits records.
Yeah, but it's extremely.
Ah, there's the timer.
There's the timer. Well,
I'm not sure what time I started. Oh, do you know what I'm excited about?
Oh, what's he excited about?
I was listening to a Nick Cave interview and what's his tits? Oh, my tiny brain.
Warren Ellis.
Not Chad Blake, the other one.
the two producers.
The two producers.
Chad Blake and...
Dave Friedman.
Dave Friedman, oh, okay.
Well, I don't know why I paired Chad. I guess, you know, I think the reason that I paired those two is because I think they're two engineer producers who just have a real sound.
Yeah.
So Friedman, you just like, there's like a Friedmanism, right?
They're not purists.
Yeah. But they have a very identifiable sound. Anyway, Dave Friedman has mixed a new Bad Seeds album.
Interesting. Oh, okay.
Can't wait to hear that.
Yeah.
It's not out. Obviously, I don't know when it's out, but
because the last one is very sort of soundscapey and swirly and stuff, isn't it?
Yes.
And I can't imagine Dave Fridman touching that. You know.
Yeah. But
did Fridman produce it or
no? Okay. Fridman mixed it. Nick Cave gave this interview where he's like, it was quite funny. He's like, yeah, me and Warren, we don't really know what we're doing. So we went to Dave Fridman and he's like, and it sounds amazing. He was like really enthusiastic about it. I was like, I can't wait to hear this.
I wasn't sure you were going to do a Nick Cave impression there.
I did. Yeah. that was sort of,
I think that was miscellaneous Australian / New Zealand.
I apologize to any Australian and New Zealand listeners.
I know there is at least one Australian. Two Australians who listen to this podcast.
I apologise to both of you.
Dear the Australians who listen to this podcast, please write in, rate Matt's Nick Cave impression out of 10.
I'm sorry, but that's a great reference for you. So basically, if the record you're doing, if everything wants to sound like Bone Machine, okay, it's got to be no low end, no high end.
I don't know if we're doing that, but
just
yeah.
Use 57s.
Yeah.
And
well, we're going to make the starting point. I'm like, let's make the live room as live as possible.
Yes.
There's a lot of things in there to control the sound.
Yeah.
We're going to get rid of those.
Yes. That's cool, Matt. Well, enjoy it, Dan.
Thank you very much.
Don't ruin it.
What are you doing this week?
I am mixing.
Great.
I'm mixing. Got a writing session Tuesday, Wednesday. Uh-huh. And I'm mixing the rest of the week. This Deep Blue.
Cool, man.
Record. I'm very excited about because they're very good. I keep
the harmonies.
Keep giving the Deep Blue a shout out.
Shout out
week.
The Deep Blue.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, we will see you next week. If you want to email in, it's podcast@urchinstudios.co.uk. That's podcast@urchinstudios.co.uk. Send us a direct message, WhatsApp or whatever you like. And we'll see you next week.
Next week. Bye, everybody.
That was easily the most professional ending I've done.
Quite good, isn't it?
Bye!